I want to start by welcoming you all to the first official, it's either the first official event of academic year 2019-2020, or the last official event of 2018-2019, because we start at the end of September. A conversation with Dr. Vic Schoenbach, and I convey that we are just informal, this is just nothing structured or anything, but of course, for those of you who know Dr. Schoenbach, you know he has gadgets and video and so forth. So we are scheduled from noon until about 2, and that's just informal time. You don't have to stay here the whole time. We have a couple things happening today. I'll introduce someone who knows Dr. Schoenbach really well, who will actually do the introduction of Dr. Schoenbach. Then we also are sharing something with the whole community today that Dr. Schoenbach was a really big part of. Let me just start by saying I'm Chandra Ford. I direct the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. Today's event is a conversation with Dr. Vic Schoenbach. Tomorrow we have another event, which is a live stream of a panel on structural racism that's hosted by the University of North Carolina. Dr. Schoenbach will actually be joining us here for that, and Dr. Kia Screen-Jeffers, who's here, will also be facilitating a discussion around structural racism. That's one of her areas of research. But before we go any further, let me say that over the last year and a half or so, a number of scholars and researchers and activists from around the country have been involved with trying to pull together material to help the field of public health begin to treat racism seriously as a public health issue. As part of that, the center led in writing an edited book. And a number of you in this room were part of that. So if you were a part of that, would you just take a moment and stand so that we can acknowledge you?
Okay.
So I've asked Natalie Bradford, who was the graduate student researcher who totally shepherded myself, Derek Griffith, Marino Bruce, and Keon Gilbert, the co-editors, in completing this project, and really did, I can't even begin to try to convey how much work she's done. And Portia Toussaint, who has been the center coordinator since the center started, to do the honors, opening the shipment of books that our center received. So. Oh, yes, of course.
Do you have scissors?
Pardon?
This is key. Eleanor, if you like this on the picture.
Study racism, you know that this is a really important topic right now. There are a lot of people who are studying it right now and over the last few years, this has really become a big, even trendy thing. We wanted to situate our current work in the context of what people have been doing for many, many years. Some of those people, we know their names. Some of those people, we do. Most of those people, I would say, we probably do not. One of those people is actually Dr. Vic Schoenbach, who has been documenting. Part of the work that you've been doing has been to document much of the anti-racism efforts within the field over the last, actually, several decades. And so with that, I am just going to introduce Millicent Robinson, who is a second-year doctoral student in the Department of Community Health Sciences. She is a student affiliate of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. She earned master's degrees in social work and public health, both at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She has studied with Dr. Schoenbach directly, and it is my pleasure to invite her to introduce her former professor.
Sorry, I was not able to print out the picture from my laptop. So today, I am extremely honored to introduce you all to today's guest, Dr. Vic Schoenbach. Dr. Schoenbach is an emeritus associate professor from the Department of Epidemiology at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. His career has spanned 38 years. He holds degrees in economics, public health education, and epidemiology. He has done work in smoking cessation, HIV seroprevalence, partner notification for HIV positive persons, STI epidemiology, HIV in African Americans, and concurrent sexual partnerships. He's done a lot within his career with the assistance of several co-instructors and nearly 250 epidemiology graduate students. Dr. Schoenbach has taught introductory epidemiology. He has been involved with the UNC School of Public Health Minority Health Project, which presents interactive broadcasts on health equity topics, and works with the Minority Student Caucus and its annual Minority Health Conference. And fortunately, I was able to meet Dr. Schoenbach in his class that he co-taught with the late Bill Jenkins, entitled Social Justice and Equality in Search of John Katz's Epidemiology. So I actually unofficially audited that course that semester because I was wrapping up my dual degree. And so I had a friend to tell me about the course, and I sat in. And I was just amazed at the information that Dr. Schoenbach and the late Bill Jenkins shared. For me, coming from social work, going into public health, and learning more about health disparities and just minority health, and also how racism impacts health, that knowledge and that experience actually contributed to why I'm doing what I'm doing now. And so I'm very honored to introduce Dr. Schoenbach, and thank you so much for serving as an unofficial mentor. I remember when I was applying to doctoral programs, we actually had a couple of conversations, and just you sharing that advice was very, very instrumental for me. And so I'm honored to see you again and just have this conversation with you all today. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Millie, for the gracious introduction and for being in that class. That was a very special class. So I don't know, do we have time to go around the room to meet people's names and just a little bit about what they, who they are or what they do?
I think she might be the first.
Oh my goodness.
So that's Naomi. Almost
3 months.
Could you say hi?
Hi, Naomi.
Right, it's too many people in here.
And I'm Rebecca. I'm a doctoral student here at CHS. Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Bradford. I am a doctoral student in the Department of Policy and Management. I'm also a registered researcher with the Center for Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health.
Hi, everybody. My name is Michael. Michael Anderson, PhD student over in the Graduate School of Education.
Yeah. AJ, I'm a postdoc here in CHS.
Ooh.
I'm Jamie, staff in CHS, and I work closely with Dr. Ford over in France.
Hi,
I'm Melba Tober. I'm the fund manager in CHS.
I'm Preeti Thomas. I'm the department manager of CHS.
I guess
we're,
I don't know actually.
Maybe. Portia Toussaint, program manager, MPH for Health Professionals Program, former center coordinator, but staff affiliate.
Nice.
Hello, everyone. My name is Elston Bo Jr. I just finished my undergrad at UCLA.
Congrats.
I'm Shars Dipsilar, and I'm staff at OIT.
I'm sorry, your name was?
Shars Dipsilar.
Staff at where?
OIT. And got an email from someone in New York about this event.
Really?
In where?
In New York.
A friend in New York sent me an email about the event.
What is OIT?
Office of Information Technology.
Oh, great. Great. It was somebody who knew I'd need help.
I'm Adrian Bakong. I am a doctoral student in the Department of Community Health Sciences.
I'm Anna Hang. I'm also a doctoral student in Community Health Sciences and a student affiliate with the center.
I'm Taylor Rogers. I'm a doctoral student in Health Policy and Management.
I'm Kia Screen Jeffers, and I'm an assistant professor in the School of Nursing.
So, we have no formal structure,
we're
just here to chat.
That's great. That's great. This is a great honor for me, and also a great pleasure. As Millie said, I've been involved in this, in public health now for actually 40-something years, because I first heard about public health in 1972, when I was trying to meet a young lady so I could go in to see a movie for free. I didn't have a, I was a, not an affiliate there. Well, I guess by then I was employed, but I didn't have a privilege card. So I was standing online chatting with this young lady, this man comes up and he's kind of looking at us. And I thought, oh, I realized that they're together, he was parking a car. So I said, oh, excuse me. And he said, well, stay, join us, you know, that's fine. So he was Guy Stewart, the chair of the Department of Health Education. And he said, oh, and what do you do? And, you know, what, and I said, well, you know, I'm doing this, but I'm interested in sex education, maybe on campus. And he said, well, we have a new program in our health education master's now, where you can have a lot of electives or do a lot of field work, and the campus is now going to be a field site. So I applied and got into health education, and in those days they had traineeships, so I got a public health traineeship. And that's where I encountered public health and epidemiology. So to think that I actually had a career there and became a tenured faculty member and retired with a pension, and that people have appreciated some of what I've done, it's just, I mean, it's just amazing to me. I as I said in an earlier talk that Chandra went, I felt somewhat like an imposter getting an award. I'll accept what I've been given. So serendipity has been a big part of my career. And if you want advice, probably you shouldn't take it. So I'm not sure how the conversation works. I had slides from something I did last year. I can flip through them quickly just to give you some thoughts in your head if you want, and then we can talk. I won't actually present the lecture.
I'd like to, I don't know where the book is, but the first major chapter of the book is a chapter that's really the only chapter like it in the book that talks about the history of people doing this work. And I wonder, it doesn't need to be anchored to the book, but could you talk a little bit about that work? And help to just set the context in.
So I never expected to be writing or working on a chapter for a book on racism. That was not something that I had any business doing. But Chandra wanted Bill Jenkins to write the chapter, and she knew that Bill needed facilitation. So I was working with Bill for, I think maybe it took us 2 years of the 3 months that we were supposed to. Chandra was extremely patient. She really worked to get that book out. Bill wrote, and I edited, and so on, but Bill was having trouble getting to some of it, so I went to the UNC archives and spent some time reading through old documents that they had. And I put a lot of them on the web, I put some of them on the web, and I actually have scanned, had a lot of them scanned, so at some point maybe we can figure out how to make them more available. Mm-hmm. Going back to the 60s, I don't know how many of you know UNC's history, but UNC, as part of North Carolina, was a segregated institution up until a court decision in the mid-50s. And that integrated the law school, because they had to have separate but equal, and there was no black law school that was like the UNC one, so they had to have, they admitted, I think, 4 law students, and it was not a big deal in that sense, but it was a big deal in other ways. And then they managed to get undergraduates in. The School of Public Health, I think, integrated around 1960 or something. I think that was when they admitted the first African-American students. The first African-American MPH graduate, I think, was, 1961. I've got that in the book, I think. So I didn't personally get knowledge of what was going on. Well, I met Bill Jenkins in the 70s when I was a doctoral student in epidemiology. And in 1972, when I entered the Department of Health Education, this is hard to believe now, there were approximately 20 students in the class, and half were African American. It was, you know, it was the only time it had ever been, not before and not after. There were some really terrific people in that class, like Ethel Jean Jackson, you know Ethel Jean, and a number of others, and Laverne Reed, who became the chair of the Department of Health Education at North Carolina Central University. I recorded an interview just 2 months ago with Ethel Jean Jackson's husband, Curtis Jackson. Ethel Jean, unfortunately, is not able to do interviews now, but I had that interview with Curtis, and I haven't quite gotten it totally public so you can find it, but if you go to my YouTube channel and look at interviews, I think you can find it through that, through the playlist. But I'll make it searchable soon. I was waiting for a family member to look at it. The minority students at the School of Public Health formed a caucus in 1971, and they issued a list of requests to the dean. One of which was that there be a minority recruiter hired, and Bill Small was hired, I think, within months. The dean was very supportive, as were several other faculty. There was a committee, and this is, some of this is laid out in the book. And in 1977, the caucus decided they wanted to put on an annual conference, and Bill Small was certainly supporting this activity, as was a committee of faculty. And Bill Jenkins was part of the, he's not listed in the committee, Bill always liked to keep a low profile. The man who came up with the idea was Bobby Kelly, who was working for, I'm blocking on the name right now, the community, the planned community in North Carolina that was going to be a black town. It will come back to me maybe. A famous man was leading it and was his boss, and he was the first keynote of the Minority Health Conference. So anyway, they decided to put on an annual conference, started in 1977. It's still going on. They missed a couple, but the 40th conference was last February. So I'm getting into a long story that I better shorten, because it's supposed to be a conversation. So jumping ahead, I attended some of the conferences, but I didn't have any other involvement with it until 1991. I'd gotten a grant, and I'd used the conference as part of the justification or the support for why this was an appropriate place to have a minority cancer control research program. And I went to Bill Small, and I said, but Bill, the conference hasn't happened for 2 years now, and I've got this grant. So he said, let's get it going again. So he talked to the students, and they restarted the conference in 1991. It was like several hundred people attending. And I got involved in something called the Minority Health Project, separate from the conference, that was putting on an annual meeting that was started by three faculty, not me. But they all moved on, and so I ended up inheriting that. And before I inherited it, it had become had a video element added to it. So at that time, it was satellite broadcast. And so we continued the satellite broadcast, and webcast. Eventually, it turned into web also, and then only web. And I suggested to the Minority Health Student Caucus that they might want to do a webcast of the keynote from the Minority Health Conference, because the Minority Health Conference had moved from the School of Public Health to the main conference center. It had maxed it out. They were turning people away. So they decided, okay, we'll webcast the keynote. And so they webcast the keynote every year. The keynote has as many people on it as the conference did, though it's just the keynote. So that's when my involvement began. It was in 1991 that I first got involved. And that was also the year that the American College of Epidemiology created a committee on minority affairs. Ray Greenberg was the president. He was the son of the dean of the School of Public Health when I first started there. And Gladys Reynolds at the CDC, she was the conference chair of the 1991 conference. Bill Jenkins was on the committee. And they came up with a provocative name at that era, very provocative, morbidity mortality gap. Is it race or racism? And I gather CDC told Bill Jenkins he had to take that word out of the title. The Bill, being the person he is, didn't. So it eventually went into the MMWR with that title. And at that same time, Bill led the formation of SAFHI, Society for the Analysis of African American Public Health Issues, SAAPHI. Chandra Ford has been president of SAFHI. Bill was the first president. Mickey Mays, also UCLA, was the second president. So anyway, this is in here, and other things as well. But it's been an honor for me. I've worked with Bill Jenkins since 1991. He was on the Committee on Minority Affairs that we created. And there's a lot of more that he did. I tried to put a lot of it in the book, but we did. He tried to keep his work out, and I tried to keep it in. So. Hi.
Can we take questions?
Please, yeah. Otherwise, I'll just keep talking.
Okay. And I'll try to be, sharing, because I have several questions. I want to start with, all right, so I love to do this about sort of people who I think are senior in my field, is just look at their publication record versus their other activities. A trend. I'm weird. A trend I find is often the publication record does not reflect what they're doing in advocacy and policy. And I do think, I'm going to mix this with my second question, I do think us as a younger generation, I'm particularly a millennial, we can be judgmental of our senior researchers and be like, why didn't you push the needle further? But for me, that contrast between the publication record, which for you is a lot in risk and risky behavior, but the advocacy is in structural racism and how to move institutions in a way where you can change the research. What are we not getting as younger researchers? What do we need to sort of learn for you or pay attention to in engaging these particular structures as to not widen the gap between the research record and then the advocacy that we're doing so that it's reflected in both spaces?
You're probably going to be hard questions.
That's a really real question. Like, I really want to know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know also.
Or what did you observe? What were your colleagues talking about at that time? Maybe that's a sort of introduction into it. Kind of conversations were you guys having about what you're having to publish versus the advocacy that you're actually doing?
So, my publication record is not so stellar, and I was not promoted to full professor because I was not regarded nationally known for my research. So if you say that the two aren't in balance, some people would say they are in balance. I'm a kind of a off and on advocate. I'm an off and on researcher. So you go through life trying to navigate. And I told you how I didn't tell you how I found epidemiology. I won't take the time now. I recorded it at my retirement party, and in some interviews. But I got into epidemiology, and I learned about research and so on, and then I wanted to do something after I was graduating, and there was an opportunity to, in those days, I got a postdoc with my advisor, and there was a chance to work with the Shep Center for Health Services Research, its name is different, the Health Services Research Center, on something called health risk appraisal, which I didn't really know about, but, you know, they had money, and they could hire me, and I could stay there. So, I mean, I didn't go to various places doing searches. I mean, I didn't follow searches. I wanted to continue living in Chapel Hill. So I got that job, and then I did what they told me I should do. And of course, then I'm encouraged to publish, so I tried to publish something. And I wasn't an advocate then because I wasn't woke, I guess is the term now, though. I don't really know what woke means, so that would be risky to say that, but it's probably true. Then, you know, I'm working with the Health Services Research Center, and they said, well, you know, we got to bring in money, and here's this organization here that is interested in having our services, so maybe we could write a proposal for them, and that was something called the AID Association for Lutherans, and I worked on that, and then a smoking cessation RFA came out from the National Cancer Institute. This was the first time big money for smoking cessation was going to be, big research money was going to be available, pretty much, and I didn't really know about smoking cessation. But, you know, I was needing to do research and liked research and health promotion. That was kind of my area, social, epi and whatnot. So I teamed up with Tracy Orleans at Duke, who was a smoking cessation expert, clinical psychologist, and some other people. And we put together a grant proposal and it got funded. So then I had money. And then I realized that epidemiology is about management. And I didn't know anything about management. So that was an interesting experience. But, you know, I wasn't thinking advocacy because I'm just trying to make my way in the world and get, I wasn't even on the tenure track then. So we worked on the study, and then I think we'd gotten funded, but we hadn't actually started it. Another RFA came out from the National Cancer Institute for smoking prevention and cessation in African Americans. And we got this grant coming in on smoking cessation, self-help approaches to smoking cessation, which was going to be done in collaboration with Group Health Cooperative. Ed Wagner was another key person on that project. He was at Group Health by then. So we said, hey, you know, we got this proposal, it just got funded, why don't we just, you know, reorient a little bit and aim it for African Americans? And we had a connection with North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, the largest black managed life insurance company in the country, at the time at least. And I got to meet Dr. Charles Watts, who was their vice president, a wonderful man, the first African American to be in the North Carolina Medical Society, among other many other things. And Charles Blackman, who was I'm not sure if he was a vice president then, but he became a vice president. And we developed this proposal, and at a certain point, Tracy Orleans called me, because she was a major part of this, and she said, Vic, I'm not sure this is going to work because, you know, this is a very different population. It's a very different organization we'll be working with. I think maybe just sending out these pamphlets that we were going to quit smoking pamphlets isn't going to work. And so with a few weeks to go, we redesigned the study into one where the agents, because NC Mutual had agents who would make personal interactions, would deliver the smoking cessation materials. Happened to have the personal mediation. So we refashioned the proposal, and it got funded. And so then I had these two big smoking cessation grants, and I didn't think about advocacy, I didn't think about anything. It was just, how in the world are we going to get this work done? I didn't know management. There were all sorts of issues I was learning about. And it was a challenge to do the collaboration. The one at Group Health Cooperative was very straightforward, because Ed Wagner was there heading the center, And Bill Beery was there heading another center we collaborated with, so that was all, and they were used to doing research. NC Mutual, on the other hand, wasn't used to doing research. The people who were there had jobs that were real jobs. I mean, they were researchers. Yeah, they were trying to sell insurance and keep the organization running and stuff. So it was a big challenge, and we had data problems. At a certain point, we realized that we were getting questionnaires, and it's possible the agents didn't really deliver them. That agents may have filled out the questionnaire. I mean, you get things like that that you have to start worrying about. I remember we were trying to do some validation calls, and we started asking height on the question because we thought, well, that way we can see if it's consistency. And we were checking over, and we saw a difference between the height on the baseline questionnaire and the height on the follow-up. And I don't remember the numbers, but it was like, you know, something like 5'2 versus 5'8 or whatever. So we would make phone calls to the people, and we said, excuse me, you just want to check something. Your baseline questionnaire said 5'2, and your follow-up questionnaire said 5'8, which is correct. And the person said, yes, that's correct. So, you know, because they didn't trust us. I mean, why should they trust us? So it was a different, you know, it was a complex thing. I have the paper on, we published one paper with the baseline survey results, and I wrote two other papers, one of which is online, but not published. So as I was doing this, I was getting an education about health disparities research. And I realized, for one thing, as I went to visit agents, we visit a little bit of their policyholders, I realized that, you know, we thought smoking cessation was really important. It is really important from a public health standpoint. It clearly is. But these people aren't necessarily worried about that as their number one priority. Mm-hmm. So you think of community-based participatory research. This was not really community-based participatory research, except to the extent that NC Mutual was the community. So I began to learn more. And at a certain point, I began to think, you know, I'm not the one who should be doing this kind of research. We need to have minority researchers. We need to have people who are in some way at least closer to from the community, even if they've got PhDs, at least they came from the community at some level, rather than me. So I kind of moved more towards being a co-principal investigator rather than principal investigator. I worked with Dorothy Brown, who did a project with largely African-American middle school populations. And then a couple years later, I started working with Ada Adamora, who's an African American infectious disease epidemiologist and physician. We wrote a proposal together to do a study of HIV in rural North Carolina in African Americans. And I've done several studies with her since then, and I've been the co-PI and she's been the PI. And so, I don't know if I've answered, I mean, I'm sure I haven't answered your question, but I'm not sure I'm the person who can tell you. So I became more of an advocate, and then in 1991, when this Committee on Minority Affairs was created, I was asked to chair it. And I said, that's a joke, Ray, you don't mean me. And so I called Sherman James, who was now at Michigan, and someone I had known for years at UNC. And he was going to be on the committee. And I said, Sherman, you'd want to be chair, right? He said, no, Vic, you be chair, because you'll do what we tell you to, and we won't have to put in the time. So on that basis, I said, OK, sure. I could be a co-PI, essentially. So Bill Jenkins was on the committee, and you know, a number of other, Gladys Reynolds and other important people, and who really knew what we should be doing. We had a few meetings, we made plans, we had monthly conference calls. We developed a statement of principles, which is a very good document, and Bill Jenkins paid me the ultimate compliment, saying he wished he drafted it. So it got refined a lot over the time, but it really lays out a good roadmap, and it's not one that has been followed, but it's there to keep going back to. So I'm going to be quiet now and see if you can give me some more direction or if somebody else wants to.
So are you saying that it wasn't a conscious choice to separate your advocacy from your scholarship?
Well, you know, some of the scholarship, you could say it is advocacy. I mean, you know, there are people who say you shouldn't make any recommendations in your publications. Some people say, you know, there's the methods or the results, and then there's the discussion, and that's where you get to say your thing. But other epidemiologists say, no, that the discussion is to interpret the data, and you're not supposed to be, I mean, like Ken Rothman, I think, says you're not supposed to be making recommendations, or at least one of his graduates did. I remember an SER meeting where at the end of her talk, she was giving, I don't know, a prize paper or something like that, and somebody said, well, so what are the what are the policy recommendations based on your study? And she said almost verbatim what Ken Rothman had been preaching, which is, we don't make policy recommendations, we put the data out with its interpretation, and then the policy making is left to the policymaker. I mean, there, as I've gotten older, I've come to think there are no right answers to important questions. That everything one does has multiple effects. Some are positive by some perspectives, and some are negative by some perspectives. Some occur in the immediate, some occur later, some occur in the distant future. Some occur to the people right around you, some occur to the further away, some occur whatever it is. And different people are affected in different ways. So everybody has his or her own take on something. And that's what kind of determines what happens. I mean, like, what's epidemiology? You can look in the dictionary, you can make an advocate, you could be an advocate, but epidemiology is what the people who control the field decide it is. If you want to get money to do epidemiology, you're going to have to go by the peers and the policy, you know, the various whatever. If you want to publish something, I mean, I submitted manuscripts that I thought were pretty good, my co-authors thought they were good, and they were turned down. One person said, you've already published this. The reviewer said, this has already been published. And I knew that wasn't right, because that study was the N.C. Mitchell study. And I wrote back to the editor. The editor never replied to me. I was going through a depression, so I didn't pursue it. But, I mean, I got that. And I got other, I mean, you get feedback, because it's just people. I mean, you'll be peer reviewers, and you'll be writing things out, and I'm sure you'll do a good job, but, you know, you'll have your perspective. You might say, the problem with this is there's not enough advocacy. You know, this person should be advocating. But another reviewer might say, there's too much advocacy. So it's a social process. It's an emergent phenomenon where all these different agents, in this case epidemiologists or other researchers, because I just use epidemiologists in the broad sense, because anybody who studies population health is an epidemiologist, even if they don't have that title or degree. But you have all these researchers debating with each other indirectly or directly. So some people would say I've been an advocate. Other people would say, you know, Vic, you should be out there advocating. I don't know that advocacy is the big shortfall, though. I mean, I don't know that that's what we're missing. I think we're missing understanding more than that. And, we experience our lives in a certain way, but if you look at the layers, we're biological creatures in a population of biological creatures in an ecosystem. And what's going on in our mind is affected by what's going on in our brain and the rest of our body. The hormones affect the way we think, react, what we attend to. And the hormones change from various things. The nutrients we intake affect us. Electromagnetic radiation may affect us. There's a lot of question about whether it causes cancer. But cancer causing cancer, that's a pretty big deal. Doesn't mean it can't influence our thinking a little bit. I think now they have better treatment for depression, transcranial, whatever it is for depression, that's heavy duty, but that doesn't mean, you don't have to do very much to a brain, necessarily. We don't know. But, you know, the neurons are getting excitatory stimuli and inhibitory stimuli, and there's a balance of those things. And if the balance tips, it doesn't maybe take much to tip the balance, and then the neuron fires and it goes off to the next one. So if there's a little bit of a bias from things like electromagnetic radiation, that's totally speculative on my part. or from some chemical that you're exposed to, an estrogen disruptor, or more mimic, or whatever it is. If there's a little bit of a bias, it could change your thinking just a little bit. It doesn't take much. Oh, you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe I could learn something here. Or, I don't think I'm interested in this person. Or that person just looks, you know, it looks kind of sketchy to me. I don't think I'm interested. I mean, all these different influences that have profound effects on our behavior and what we do could be influenced by fairly small things. You know, I don't like the way he looked at me. I think probably I can't trust him. And we make judgments like that all the time. And of course, implicit racism is enormous. But that's just one of the many things. And even racism isn't always black-white. There are the different shades, the different features, and what part of Africa did this person originally come from, and how much white blood got in there. I mean, and what part of white, you know, whites are a diverse, not as diverse, but a diverse population too. So, you know, life is much more complex than I think we are used to thinking about. And so we oversimplify. And we have to oversimplify. You couldn't do science if you didn't oversimplify. But when you oversimplify, of course, then not everything's going to be correct. So I think understanding more about why people behave the way we do, why you get some people with billions of dollars who give it away and try to use it to better society. And other people with billions of dollars use it to try to mislead people, to suppress, to despoil the environment. I mean, that's an epidemiologic question, I think. What's going on? What kind of a species can we be if we destroy our planet? With all our, hey, Gil. So Gil was a speaker in that broadcast, one of those broadcasts back in 2007. Does racism make us sick? As well as another one, but that's the one that was the biggest. So we are so advanced in our civilization. We have this incredible knowledge store of knowledge and institutions, and we have this enormous wealth. And we're destroying our environment. We're having all these children grow up without basic necessities, without intellectual stimulation, that they would emotional stimulation, early childhood development, the kinds of things that produce epigenetic effects that last for a lifetime. What's the matter with us? I think that's a huge problem. But it's not just an advocacy question, because there are people advocating. And my voice, adding my voice to the advocacy, isn't going to change anything. But if we could get epidemiologists and other researchers understanding what's going on, why is it people are interacting fairly ineffectively? That, I think, could help. So that's my advocacy.
Show and tell, and I just
want
to make sure we have time to get
it. I mean, it's most important to me that, I mean, I have this on, I will put this on the web and people can look at it, but are there any, I mean, this is supposed to be a conversation, it's becoming dangerously like Vic's talking again. My wife will see this video and she'll say, you know, Vic, you can't get away from it. Gotta shut up.
I mean, along those lines, I have a question about the influence of your mother, because I also do that kind of research, too.
Good.
I will look into your history and all those things. Since you've invested a lot of time and energy into understanding how people's cultures, environment, how structural racism influences them. I mean, how have you been influenced through your particular family and ancestry? I did look at sort of your father passing younger and your mother raising you. So what did you get from her? What did you get from your ancestry? What did you...
First of all, I haven't done as much research as you were describing. I learned many years ago. So my mother told me that my father had an ability to grasp the key ideas in something from only a little bit of exposure to it. And I always thought, maybe I've got that ability too. And as a result, I actually don't go into things very deeply often. I just try to glean a few ideas from them. So maybe that seems to work. I've gotten by my through my career with it. So, I mean, I've obviously worked on some things, but you know what you described, boy, that would have been a career I should have done, but I didn't. What I've gotten from my parents, my father was in the Army Medical Corps when I was born in World War II. He was overseas, I think, when I was born, though I don't know for sure. My mother was a lawyer. She was one of, I think it was 8 law students in the city of Boston when she went to law school, female law students. And the professor said, you know, you're taking up a man's place. And she was a lawyer for a little while. There was only one firm in New York City that would hire a female lawyer. New York City, one firm. She had a job, she worked as a lawyer for a while, but then she was having, then they moved to Boston for my father's career, and she started having babies, and she became a full-time stay-at-home mom. And, you know, money was kind of tight in those days. This was during the war. Then my father passed away when I was 8. He had just gotten a new job. He was now going to be director of a medical department in Brooklyn, New York, in Maimonides Hospital. He passed away, and my mother was there with 3 children, and not a whole lot of money, and some question about whether the life insurance was really going to be paid, and she raised us, and she's had an enormous effect. Not easy for me to talk about. I didn't know my father very well. I knew him a little bit. But my mother's had a huge influence. Most of what you hear from me probably comes thanks to her. turns out my father did epidemiology. I later found that he was on the Army Epidemiological Board. I discovered on the web years later. And he did work on meningitis, I think. Actually, I've got a handkerchief. I tear up easily. Don't worry about it. No, it's okay.
I just get a lot of meaning out of those kind of stories. So.
Well, that's why I started recording interviews, and I really recommend it. And you don't need to know anything, because I didn't know anything. I do remember to press the start button. You just sit down and have a conversation that's being recorded, and ideally you get some backup audio. I left it down there, so I hope it's picking up the folks. But it's all right. I mean, my voice will carry. Don't put it near me. And it's good to have it down there. No, for those of you there, but if you put it near me, it'll just, I'm loud enough. I really recommend it. I mean, there was the Sherman James interview, which was phenomenal. But I've got a great interview with Shonda Ford, and you will be very interested to hear her life story when she lets me make it available to you.
I was about to say, it's not even available.
It's as available as she wants it to be.
So bad.
Maybe you could invite a few of your people to review it and see if they think it would be a problem or not.
Okay, that sounds good.
I've also got an interview with Bill Jenkins.
Oh, nice.
I've got an interview with the second African-American to get a PhD from the School of Public Health at UNC, Ed Ellis. I've got an interview with one of the early African-American epi doctoral students, graduates, besides Bill Jenkins, who was another epi doctoral graduate. And I've got an interview with the first woman, first African-American, to sing with the University of North Carolina Men's Glee Club.
Oh.
She sang with them at the New York World's Fair in 1964. They went up there together, and she had to take the bus back overnight because she was a teacher in the segregated Chapel Carborough school system and had to close out school the next day. So the governor's office sent a car to pick her up at the bus station in Raleigh the next morning and take her to the school so she could finish out school. She actually lives in San Francisco in the Bay Area. It's Bernadette Otedeko is her name. She's still alive. She sang the opening, the national anthem for the, I guess it's the San Francisco Giants games. And so I've got a virtual library, and I guess I can't show it to you because I didn't. Is this on the web? Can I?
I think so. We can try. Plus, Natalie's on there. Rebecca.
Okay. Well, I see UCLA. Oh, this would be good. Okay. So let me just, as long as we're on here, look, I guess it has to do something. Well, it's finding it. Let me do this. Yeah, is there anything I have to do to say, pay attention to this rather than the other?
I think let that close that or minimize that. With that
okay, thing. I'll try that. Let me type in the URL so I'll tell you to show you.
Two screens.
It says, I kept this out of your way. Go long, gift to UNC, I mean UCLA. So you think I can end slideshow, should I say? All right, I'll say end slideshow.
There we go.
You got it. Okay, good. So this is I made this website up for the course that Bill Jenkins and I taught together. And if you want to read about Bill Jenkins, I've got a lot of places to do it, and this is one place where you can. But for part of the course, what I did was create what I'm calling a virtual library of resources. And I did that because I'm a collector and a disseminator, I'm not a discriminator. So what the students really want is, so what are the most important things that I should be reading or learning? And I could never answer that question any more than I could do AJ's question. Instead, what I did is I collected all this stuff, and I put it out there, I'll make it a little bigger. And I don't know if you can read it yet, or is it big enough to read it?
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't know why it's going off the edge there, but maybe the projector needs to be moved a little bit. Or is it the slides just not fitting in the screen? Oh, no, I guess I got too big. Anyway, it says public library resources. That's the only thing it's off. So I gave the students the assignment of reading 5 or 6 things in the library and then writing a little bit about each one as a way of giving them exposure. So the class as a whole got to be exposed to a whole lot of things. So in this thing, I've got a section on big challenges in public health. So that has a section on adversity, poverty, a section on aging, cheating, counterfeiting, misrepresentation, conflict, early childhood development. You know, just all the major, or not all, but many of the major issues that public health deals with. And if you go into these things, there's a lot in them. Many of them, I have videos, audio from radio programs, NPR particularly, but not only. And then I have a section on, I was talking about neuroscience before, so I've got this section on choice, behavior, decision making, perception, cognition, emotion, neuroscience. Some of the really good stuff, unfortunately, got put behind a firewall or they took it down. You know, Charlie Rose? Mm-hmm. Okay, so Charlie Rose did this series on neuroscience with, I'm blocking his name right now, at Columbia, who was a pioneer neuroscientist. It's had a huge career, and it'll come back to me maybe later. But anyway, they put together this series, and they had all these great presentations on neuroscience. And I don't know, but I think when Charlie Rose got labeled in the Me Too movement, they took away all the things about it that he did. So somewhere, hopefully it'll be resurrected at some point, they were great. Great, very educational. But people are not all good or all bad. And not everything one does is good and bad. And it can, becoming more nuanced, I think, is a valuable thing. So then I have applied sciences like demography, economics, education, epidemiology, law, political science, economics, I think is very important. And then I've got basic sciences, more basic sciences, so behavioral sciences, biological, and so on. Then I've got a thing on organizations. So organizations, academia, media organizations, I've got North Carolina, public health professional societies. So you all know about Black Ladies in Public Health?
Yes.
Good, good. Do you know about epidemiology society? Do you know about SAFI? Society for the Analysis of African American Public Health Issues. So I've got their history, I've got recordings from some of their workshops, and so on.
Can we see just like what the image of the recording was, like your conversations, just so?
So like an interview with Bill Jenkins, you mean? Sure.
Yes.
Okay. computer. That's on.
Cool. Oh, yeah.
Where was the sound on this thing? Function of this? That's it. Thank you.
Yes. Well, my maternal family were Geechee. They originally were agricultural rice growers of the island, the Polly's Island, South Carolina. Probably had been there prior to 1700, from what we can understand. And remained on that island until the Civil War when my great grandfather joined the first black regiment of the Civil War, first South Carolina Volunteers. Fought for those 4 years, and then Union fought the secession. So they went stay. Yes. Oh, along the coast, anyway. Only along the coast. Okay. Yes. And they, after the Civil War, they were mustered out near Charleston, South Carolina, on Fort Wagner, near Charleston, South Carolina, but settled on a peninsula called Mount Pleasant in a community called Greenwich, where the nurse for the regiment started a Quaker school. And so my family's been going to that school for a number of generations. So that's my maternal side. On my maternal side, they came to this country later.
Your paternal side?
My paternal side, okay. Yeah. They came to this country later. They, the young woman from the Gambia region, whose family were caught in a drought, and her family sold her into slavery in order to save the rest of the family at around 10 or 11 years of age. And then she came here to the United States.
I have a thought. I see this food there. Mm-hmm. And you all want to eat, I hope. Why don't we let the recording play?
Yeah.
And we can all get our food, and you know, and then whenever you want, we can turn the recording off and go back to talking.
Sounds
Sound good?
Great. Yeah.
On a ship called the Hannah, and so that's the name she took when she called the name they gave her. I don't know which. She landed in Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, in 1811. And she was sold to the Kirkland Plantation, which is a very famous American family, of course. In a relationship that I assume was married since they were together for 47 years, to a Scottish indentured servant, and started the family.
So this was a biracial marriage?
Yeah, I guess so.
Pre Civil War,
I guess so.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina. Wow. I think that has happened several times in my family history. The one family that several books have been written about is a family in which a woman, at least I think was her name, took the name Halston, was in a relationship with
that doesn't look as good.
One of the largest slaveholding families in America, the Ball family, more than 26,000 slaves. And they had
it's
a relationship
really
over 20 and 30 years
and
is now acknowledged as part of the
it's
Ball.
Often, yeah. You get these pictures or videos, and you can't see them in a video.
So apparently, unusual as one would have thought. So anyway, that family, the reason I mentioned that is because that family had the advantage, then after the Civil War, they got 40 acres and like four people. It's still waiting for the mule, but they got 40 acres. It gave them a leg up and they became business people. And so that family became resource. Where was this? It started in Euclid Bridge, South Carolina, but they had a conflict between the black businesses that they started and the white businesses. And so they were put in jail, and then the family decided to get them out of jail. But unfortunately, the amount of dynamite that was used was a little more than they had expected, and it kind of blew up the jail, so then everybody had to leave. So from what? Buford Bridge no longer exists as a town, but if you look at a map from where Buford Bridge was to Charleston, there are members of the family in almost every town along, I think it's Route 78, toward Charleston, South Carolina. So that's
jail.
Right, right. I don't think they meant to blow up the whole jail.
They didn't hurt the family when they did it, I
hope. No, no. Apparently they all, you know, made it out. I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened during that conflict. So they just scattered. They scattered and then ended up in Charleston.
Do you have a favorite video?
And so they started business again in Charleston.
Sherman James is another.
And then
Founder Ford is another.
Became
famous. Yes, I vote yes. Let's watch the Ford video.
Now, I'm sorry to take that. 1894.
But no.
You can take a vote.
Right?
Bill Jenkins is the interviewer.
Oh, that's what happened. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
And then
descendants of the person that can't be. So the Mulattas were your father's. Your
that's father. Right. That's right.
And they're the ones who went to Morehouse.
Right. Yeah, Morehouse, Belmont, and Howard.
And they had the businesses.
They had the businesses. Still did.
Okay. But your mother's family had the higher status?
No, no, my mother's family were tradespeople.
Tradespeople.
Yeah, so in the village I grew up in, you know, my grandmother delivered them, my mother crossed them, my father buried them. My uncles built the houses and ran the little shop. And they were all tradespeople, but small time.
And they did the orphanage?
No, but my father's family, who had a number of, you know, more well-known businesses in the city of Charleston, built the orphanage. One of the businesses, they were the primary provider of wood to the city of Charleston.
Was it your great uncle?
Yes.
And your mother's family created the school, right?
Well, they went to the school. The Quakers created the school.
Okay. Okay, I think I'm back on track.
Yeah. So my father's family went to a prep school called Avery, and then the Immaculate Conception, which is a Catholic school, the Bible says, where the Quaker school goes. My mother, who was the first person in her family to go to college, finished the Quaker school early. Was deceitful about her age and started teaching school when she was about 14 or 15. raised enough money from that to send herself to this prep school, the Avery, where she met my father. And then went to Hunter College.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. But did not finish. She ended up finishing at Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah.
What did you call it? Yeah, but in those days it was over enrollment.
What did that do?
Oh, that was late 20s, early 30s, somewhere in there. But she's kept trying to go back, but eventually it was just easier to finish it better. My mother-in-law was the first black PhD graduate from Hunter, or Columbia maybe by that time.
Really?
Yes. She also went to Hunter, but later.
Uh-huh. Mm. Columbia in what?
History. My mother-in-law is a well-known historian. Yeah, Dr. Margaret Rowley. And they celebrated her as the first black PhD graduate.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what year that was?
Oh, no, I don't. I can look it up, though.
I guess I really should be able to hear you die.
Oh, I do know. I think it was 1947 because she graduated the same year that the famous historian at Duke, who died a few years ago, they were graduated the same year, he from Harvard and from Columbia.
Yeah, I'm lucky to have been
in
the
right.
Okay, so those, and so in the 1940s when you were born, mm-hmm. your parents were both living
in Mount Pleasant, in my mother's house.
In your mother's house?
Yeah, a bungalow in Mount Pleasant.
Okay. And were you delivered by your family also?
Well, of course.
Do you remember who?
My grandmother.
You would have tried to switch.
Absolutely.
Your maternal grandmother.
My maternal grandmother. She was, she was a...
Switching that, can we get a family photo?
Oh.
Anybody got a better phone than mine?
Not
I. I don't want y'all to be mad when y'all grayscale. Okay, that Bulldog Life does not afford better phones.
I have an 8. Is it 8?
What number are we on now?
I don't
have
know.
Apparently the 11 is coming out.
There's an 11 coming out.
This one that's
just probably just not working because 11 is coming out.
I don't know what
number. Oh, my charger.
I've noticed the Androids take better pictures, though.
There you go. Oh, right here.
So I don't know who that's on.
I have one.
You have one? Okay, yeah.
All right.
The latest one.
So Rebecca?
Yeah.
What the?
This is
yeah, that one looks clear.
Oh, wait, that picture.
Yeah,
is
I think this
is yeah, the Android is better with camera.
It is. Not that you're not a jewel.
Yeah, it's a good camera.
No, I love me some mail.
Which one is it?
Galaxy S10 Plus.
You guys want to stand up, maybe, and like. You can do it really quickly?
Yeah.
Who's before people start
it?
To leave?
Oh my gosh.
I can take it.
Then you won't be in it. Is there anybody else up there?
Oh.
Or you can set the timer.
We'll see how that goes.
10 seconds.
That's
true.
She has already been.
Do you want to book it?
I'll have Jane take it.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, you want to go over? You want to take a picture?
I never saw the obituary.
Yeah, that's the thing. Most times I just do.
All right now, Taylor, we on our color scheme today.
I'm living in the
way. I'll talk about
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want
to. Yeah.
This is all okay.
Yeah.
Look at this second row coming up.
The camera is magical, but not enough to reach everybody. So maybe some people fish. The light might be okay. But I'm thinking.
It
might be better with the dog.
Maybe some people sit.
Yeah, if folks want to sit.
Oh, why did we change it? No, we did change it. But it's the same. I think it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
one of the words. It's very good. You know what? It could change the quarter. So my suspicion is that it could be. Look at the top of the page. Maybe.
Is this shit
going
to
happen?
No, it's tech. IT.
Where's the IT?
Maybe have it on the Facebook infomercial.
I never thought
that was right. Is that it right there? The other?
Study journalism.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. It's also not an HD. What is the
very good.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Just wipe up.
So you think it might be
that mine?
Yeah.
Pro. Yeah, some people sit. So we can
oh, yeah,
sit.
Some people can sit. That'd be good.
Like we're still doing tech right now.
Yeah. A little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just
in the middle. Should I sit down? Would that be?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that
would
be good. I don't want to break it. Break things.
It's not screwed all the way,
yeah,
but
don't
I don't
say.
Want to break it.
Is it on?
The
floor is it's a
turn
the floor in the bottom.
Millie, you want to sit?
Oh yeah.
Because there's one right here.
Okay, cute. Wait, let me make sure I got it.
That is a real thing.
That's nice.
Because I can guarantee you,
looking everybody in the photo and not their eyes on Twitter.
Let's see if John recalled it.
Black woman, small, dark, very strong, very masculine, very Quaker. She believed in silence and simplicity and, you know, had all of the Quaker values that one applied today or propagated today. So you mentioned that biracial marriage on my mother's side.
Oh, yeah.
No, my father's side. My mother's side, strictly Geechee. There, no intermarrying on my mother's side.
And do you have any other ethnicities represented?
No, just the Scottish guys, as far as I know, Paul Dickinson.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the only. Now, of course, many of my relatives on that side of the family married Europeans. In fact, more of them married Europeans than African Americans. Yeah.
Please, from the center here.
It took me a long time to work through the differences between myself identifying with my mother's community.
Send it to me so I can add it to the newsletter.
Do you want me to email it or text?
Either one.
What's your
sale? No, go ahead. 562-708-4960.
Because you know, like, the whiteboard's like reflecting it versus like a regular, like,
screen. Oh, that's true.
It could be, it could just be that.
So you went back to the lines for 2 years, and then
that also just more about
it. Yeah. Right. Right, Dr. May, yes, and I take speech with Ms. Mitchell for 2 years.
On Saturdays.
No credit.
Can you remember how you spoke before this?
I can't do it. I know. You know, like, some phrases like, where's your wife, I could repeat now because when people ask me that question, I went back and listened to my cousin who was still there, and I memorized certain quotes to give an idea of what it was like. Yeah.
So, you weren't interviewed before you went to Morehouse.
Well, the traditional way is simple. The Morehouse man comes to your house, Sunday dinner, he talks to your parents, and the next thing you know, you're on a train to Morehouse. That was the way it was.
So apparently the way you spoke wasn't a problem for a kid.
No, I think they just looked at my SAT scores and figured I'd get the rest of it then. Correct.
What was it like when I got home while speaking differently? You went off to Morehouse speaking.
Yeah, well, first of all, it was 8 years before I ever went back.
Go back at all?
No.
Holidays?
No.
Summers?
No.
What was that?
The only time I can remember wanting to go home was when my grandmother died and I was on the phone with my mother. My mother told me, I told her I had an exam, but I could get out of it. My mother said, what would your grandmother tell you to do? So I went and took the exam.
But you must have had vacations or holidays or something.
Right. Well,
I'm just
my mother, yeah. My mother, what I have mentioned before, my mother is a Trojan wife. A Trojan mother, when the son becomes of age,
don't believe in vacations.
The mother gives the son a shield.
Time on.
And say, come back with the shield or on the shield.
You still had your shield, right?
Well, I was not in her mind on course. And because I got involved in the civil rights movement, went to jail, things like that. Going back home for me and facing my mother would have been extraordinarily difficult.
That's the operating principle. And so then you got involved in the civil rights movement?
Yeah.
Early on.
Right. Well, when I was a freshman at Morehouse. Well, I got involved even before that, working for Esau Jenkins, no relation, registering people to vote in Charleston County.
So what year did you go to Morehouse?
63. Okay,
yeah, that was
a busy time. Yeah, right. And I just worked in the SNCC office and went to jail. I just did what I was told. I was just a gopher, Because you had all these talkative people like Stokely and people like that coming through.
You mean Stokely Carmichael?
Oh, of course. All those people.
Kwame.
Brown.
H-Rap.
I knew his brother better than I knew H-Rap. He was not somebody I talked to. But his brother Ed Brown was older, quieter, more of my style. That's somebody.
So your brother didn't like you being in the civil rights movement?
No, because it took me off her track.
Which was?
Law school. My brother was supposed to go to med school, I was supposed to go to law school.
Oh.
So I even joined pre-law.
Have you been training for law school?
Going to jail?
Yeah.
Not my mother's view. not at all. Yeah, no, I had a straight line that I was not supposed to veer from. And I veered. I went to Morehouse, I started pre-law, my
my professor, my advisor from Harvard Law School, because more outside this relates to the Harvard Law at the time, said I should major in math, but I was interested in Harvard Law. That's what I did. Found out I loved math, did not like law.
Which is good advice though, in terms of math.
Yeah, right. I found out the things that I loved. You know, especially after I got past the arithmetic. What people don't understand is you don't get to mathematics until you pass calculus. You know, and that's when you take abstract algebra and mathematical logic and the stuff that really turns you on, the stuff that, you know, makes you think how to approach a problem, you know, rather than just trying to work through some arithmetic, you know, equation. You're actually thinking about how to solve problems. That's the part of mathematics. We had this German logician who came from Berkeley. Morehouse was being adopted by a lot of the big schools around the country. And he would give these lectures. They were just absolutely amazing. And then they would be like 55 minutes long, not 56 minutes or 54 minutes. You know, Peter Krause, it was just absolutely an amazing.
Was this symbolic logic or?
Mathematical logic, but yeah.
Can you give me a few more? I took a symbolic logic course.
Okay.
I was trying to remember.
Well, you start out with set theory, and then you move on to the probability theory. Mm-hmm. His first doctorate was in philosophy, so he would throw out these philosophical conundrums to you and ask you to apply your mathematical training and logic to solving these conundrums. So, yeah.
I'll get my logic with my symbolic logic.
Okay.
You know, I did really well in math until after calculus.
Until after calculus? Wow. Okay.
I kind of the differential equations. I said I don't think so, and then I had to say it was a math teacher, and he was doing set theory. And
right,
like,
right,
and
right.
I looked at that and I said I don't think so.
Yeah. I was so glad to get beyond diff equations until you know.
I don't know.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. No, I didn't either. You know. But abstract algebra where. You know, people tell you for the first time that, you know, a 10-digit, you know, system is not the only system conceivable, and you try to figure out these other kinds of systems. It's absolutely extraordinary, you know. So, yeah. So,
anything else in college that you particularly like?
I liked a lot of stuff in college. I was all over the place. That I ended up graduating with something like 147 hours because, you know, I took religion. I took a number of religion courses. You know, I'd grown up Catholic. I had been involved in starting the Catholic Youth Organization in the Atlanta University Center, which is the largest black Catholic youth organization in the country. Now, three of us started that. And I was very interested in the religious courses. I took a course from Dr. Blakey, who God is Dead, you know, back in the 60s. That, you know, fascinating. That course, I worked out on that course than any other course I ever took in college. The readings were outrageous, and it was difficult. You know, I did extra theater and stuff like that I liked, sang and stuff like that. But you know, I loved math. Oh, and I minored in psychology, so I taught, I tutored the statistical lab for psychology students, and then I ended up being allowed to give lectures.
So, you've heard a lot about Bill.
Wow. Yeah, Yeah,
but
well, I was gay.
This is from a long time ago. This is from like 4 years ago.
Test
or something.
Waters.
But
so that was extraordinary.
In 2017, Society for the Analysis of African American Public Health Issues. The Society for the Analysis of African American Public Health Issues had its 25th anniversary meeting.
and there was a past president's panel. And so there's a few minutes at the end that I was going to invite you to listen to with Bill. He'd be one of the past presidents, the first president.
Blessing for all of us here this morning.
First of all, I'm teaching. I love that. It's a privilege being here in my life to be in Gala. I was known that I grew up in with the descendants of the first black president in the Civil War. So we've been fighting success for generations. I grew up
special guy. Oh, that's Chandra, by the way. Chandra was also a past president of Philippines, actually. And Kamara Jones was seated with her. So, I don't know, I guess we still have another 15 or 10 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Time. Let me put this to sleep or leave it on, I guess.
So that video you just showed ended with Dr. Bill Jenkins saying that it's the experiences, and so the experiences we have that motivate us to keep going. What are some of the experiences that you have had that motivated you to keep going?
You guys ask hard questions.
It's not my fault. You brought it up.
Bill's a trouble. Well, I mean, you know, I've had a very fortunate life. Yes, I lost my father. That was very unfortunate, for sure. But I've had white privilege. Although in the beginning of life, our money was not ample. It was adequate. And since then, I think I count this affluent. Why wouldn't I keep on? I interact with people I enjoy interacting with. I'm appreciated. I'm doing things that are, I don't like grading. And when I retired, that's one thing I was so glad to give up grading. But talking with people, that's fine. sharing things that I've got. I've collected all this stuff during my career, and I want to share it because I'm not going to take it with me, or I will, but that won't be very useful. So I've got all this material, video, collections, websites, and stuff that I want to share with people. So experiences that want me to keep going. I guess, I got an award from the American College of Epidemiology, thanks to Sean Burry and some other colleagues. Yeah, that motivates me to keep going, I guess. Yeah. My health won't hold back forever, I know that. Aging is the goal of public health. So we don't look down on aging. But it does come with some aspects that are not always enjoyable. And at some point, those will catch up with me and I'll stop doing things. But in the meantime, now, would I need experiences that would keep me going to jail? I don't know, but I would have experiences or want experiences like that. Bill went to jail and thought it was a really valuable experience. I'm sure it would be an experience that I would learn a lot from, but I'm not hardy the way he is, I guess. So I haven't answered your question either.
I wouldn't say that. I think you did answer.
Well, I answered it. You got it. I guess, so I'm going to have to talk about this, I guess. In 1972, I suppose my style of living goes before that even. I remember back in the late 60s, early when I was in college, I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I'd just go out and walk, and I'd see where I started walking, and that would kind of tell me where I was thinking, what I apparently wanted to do. Now, did it lead me to good places? Sometimes apparently it did. It didn't lead me into too much trouble, but I couldn't decide. I didn't know what to major in college. I couldn't figure it out. I took a leave of absence. I went, I got a job in computer programming because a roommate of mine had done programming and it seemed like it might be a nice thing to do. So I took a short course on computer programming. This was with the first solid-state computer, the 1401, IBM 1401. I wrote in assembler language because that was what they had. And I worked in a bank doing computer programming for a couple of years. And then the draft got after me because this was the Vietnam era. And so when I couldn't avoid it, I jumped back into school and I started taking courses at Columbia University enough to be full-time, and I managed to get a 2S deferment. So that's what got me to finish college. And then after that, I applied to go to the London School of Economics in London because it was a way to avoid the draft. I figured if they come after me there, I'll just stay in London. I'm glad I didn't have to do that, but there was a fellow there who was doing just that. And before I went, I helped a fellow at Columbia whom I knew pack up to go to Montreal. So, but I was lucky. I was able to get another kind of a 1Y deferment from a supportive psychiatrist. And then I stayed on in London. I didn't know what to do. And it was inexpensive in those days to live there, and I had some money that I'd inherited, so I was just staying there, giving out flyers and pamphlets, largely on women's liberation. That was one of the things, one of the causes that was then coming in. That was 69 or 70, I guess. And we, when I was at London School of Economics, we had an occupation there to oppose the war and things like the Vietnam War and things like that. So I'd gotten radicalized. And that was an experience that, I don't know that it got me to keep going, but it certainly radicalized me. When I was at Columbia, it was 1968, that was my last year, and Columbia was occupied and there was a police bust and people I knew got hurt and so, and I was not an occupier. But it radicalized me. I became an armchair radical instead of just an armchair liberal. And so when I went to London, and it was safer there because the police didn't carry guns, and at least that's my understanding. So I thought, well, I should get more involved, and so I got involved. I became more of an activist. And I even did get, I don't think I was actually arrested, but there was a summons for me, and I had to go to court and so on. But that's another story I'll be happy to tell you sometime if you want. But it was very civil, very civilized, and nothing happened to me. And so after that, I didn't really know what to do, and so I just stayed on in London, and I worked for an organization called Agitprop, New Left, would sell pamphlets and things at conferences, and then after that, I was expelled from an anti-authoritarian commune, so that was another interesting experience, and,
okay.
It was kind of a Me Too thing, I'll just lay it out there, I then ended up staying on in London for a year, trying to figure out what to do, trying to write, reading. I read Wilhelm Reich. That's when I learned about sex education and began to think about it. I'm going to have to skip some of what happened then. But anyway, I ended up back in this country. I'd met a woman in London, didn't have an affair, just met a woman who was from Virginia. She told me that Chapel Hill was a nice place. So when I got back to the U.S., still not knowing what to do, I started traveling south, and I ended up visiting her in Virginia, and she and her partner drove me down to Camp Lejeune, where he was in the Marines, and then the next day or so, I hitchhiked with two Marines to Chapel Hill, because I heard it was a nice place, and this woman's brother was a freshman. So I waited at the dorm, and I said, you don't know me, I know your sister. And he said, oh, well, welcome to Chapel Hill, good to see you. Where are you staying? I said, well, I was going to ask if I could stay on your floor. White privilege.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
I admit. And so I stayed on the floor in Grimes' dorm, in his room. They didn't have the security things they have now. It'd be a little harder to do that. And Tom Randolph and Jim Rumfeld were the kind gentlemen who let me stay there. And I saw some things about the campus, and I saw they had a course on sex education, which I'd never heard of before. And I thought, well, that'd be interesting. So I sat in on it, which in those days I was able to do. It was a big course in the auditorium. And Tacky Crist, who was the OBGYN who taught it, was very welcoming. And he even gave me a lift to Raleigh, where he was giving a talk a later evening that week. He took me there, and I got to hear a talk he gave at NC State. And I forget whether it was that time or later, I asked him if I could be a teaching assistant in his sex education course. Remember, I'm not a student. I wasn't employed there. I'd never had any training in sex education. But he thought enough of what I was saying that he said, okay. So I went on to Texas. I kept on my trip south, ended up finding myself going to Texas to see a young lady whom I'd known in London, and when that didn't work out, you know, there are advantages to having less testosterone. I'm experiencing those advantages now at this point in my life. In those days, I had more than I needed, probably, more than was good for me. But anyway, So I hitchhiked back to Chapel Hill, or took the bus, I suppose. I took the bus back to Chapel Hill. As soon as I got back to Chapel Hill, it was just, I felt so much better.
And so I moved back in on the floor, the Grimes dorm, for another week, thanks to generosity. And I made the arrangement to be a TA the following semester. I think that's what happened. I got myself an apartment, and then I went away for Christmas and came back. Got mugged when I was in New York City. Not violently, but on the subway, these youngsters went through my pockets. Came back to Chapel Hill. Or maybe that was a year later. I actually can't remember which year it was. Have to check that out. And I came back and I saw an ad for a programming job, and I got a job as a computer programmer. $3 an hour was the advertised price, but they had to pay me $4 because $3 turned out was under the amount. So I had a part-time temporary job on campus. I started hanging out in the things and interacting with meeting people, and there was a student-run sex counseling service that had begun, and I started working with that. And then, as I said, I met the chair of the Department of Health Education, and then I got into the Department of Health Education, and then I started doing giving lectures on sexuality on campus, some of which are recorded if you're interested. They're not video, but I have some audio. They're kind of funny. Remember, I was only somewhat trained by then, though I had gone to a short course at the Kinsey Institute. Had an interesting experience there. Very interesting, actually. I mean, for a lot of reasons. One of the people, I'd been with the sex counseling service. And so they had a shortfall in the money they were expecting to get, so they couldn't hire their professional facilitators. I was asked if I could be a facilitator for this short course on human sexuality there. And remember, I've got a degree in economics, I've got whatever. And the economic degree was because I wrote slavishly what I thought the professors would want to see. I hadn't been going to classes at the London School of Economics, I'd been an activist. But I figured out what they would want to see, and that's what I wrote, and they gave me the degree because it was all based on the exam. So, but I had this degree, but it wasn't anything to do with sex education. Anyway, so they said, we'd like you to be a facilitator. In my group was Mary Calderon. I don't know how many of you know who Mary Calderon is. She was at that time in her 70s probably, she was a physician who had pioneered sex education. She was the founding president of SEICUS, the Society for the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S. Major organization founded in the late 60s. I'd actually joined it or been contributing to it. Still going on. And she was, that was totally ridiculous. But in those days, I was full of myself. And I thought, well, you know, I know I'm a radical, you know, I know what should be done. So I was preaching to Mary Calderon, and there was a psychiatrist in the group too, and it was ridiculous. But I remember getting up in the mornings, they would have these lectures, and they would take questions or comments. And I stood up at in one of them, and I made my comment, really, rather than a question, and sat down. And then we got to the end of the session. And this woman comes up to me and she said, "How could you say that?" And you know, I didn't really know what I was talking about, and I hadn't really thought it through that much. I just said, you know, what I thought. And I said, "Well, I just said what I thought." She said, "But you sounded so certain or authoritative or something." That's when I realized that my manner gave some gravitas to what I was saying more than was really warranted by the knowledge behind it and maybe even my intention. And that was an interesting insight. To realize several things. One is that I can fake it quite a bit. And I guess I've relied on that maybe more than I should have. And this is really turning out to be more of a self-confession. This recording is going to have to be suppressed. But the other thing is, now thinking about that, it's an illustration of how much our interactions are not as rational as we think of them. You know, we think of where, you know, what I'm saying, you know, some people would say, well, that's you're persuading them or you're convincing them or you're exploiting them or whatever it is. But there's also the other aspects of influence that are going on. Now, that is very well known in the commercial world now. And, you know, they are incredibly sophisticated about changing people's attitudes, receptivity, or making them oppose things and the Russian, you know, the trolls and that sort of thing. But So, I don't know, just to mention one thing. So, Facebook did a study. I don't think it was federally funded. I doubt they got IRB approval. So long, Angel. Where they manipulated people's Facebook feeds. This was on a giant scale, because of course they got this huge platform, so like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people probably. They manipulated them to take away the positive posts and just put through the negative posts. And they were able to detect an increase in depression on the people they were doing this to. So there's some human subjects, ethical issues about that, to be sure. But it's an indication of just how we can be influenced by things that are inapparent, and maybe not even intentional, although in this case, I mean, I don't know if they were intending this to be the outcome. They must have had some idea because they measured depression. But there's a whole lot that we don't understand in this interaction, communication, social media. You know, what are these things that are going on Twitter doing? We don't really know. And we probably can't know because you can only look at a few things. And to look at something really well, as you know, as you learn how to do research, takes a huge investment, a lot of time and stuff. So we only look at a tiny fraction. Most of what we do on the basis of gut instinct, whatever that is. And some people think that's the term gut instinct reflects the fact that we have the microbiome influencing our thinking, which it probably does. So maybe that's why it's called gut instinct. But in any case, we go on gut instinct, we go on first impressions, we go on physical appearance that we infer, maybe because for some evolutionary reason. And that's what's going on in society, in the country. Did you want to say something?
Oh, no, I had a question.
Good. Oh. Otherwise, I'll keep talking.
You can, you know, you can go, keep going if you want. Okay. My question, I'll probably say, like, from before you talking about this, like, reconceptualizing of like ways of knowing or kind of like broadening frameworks that people use, like being more critical and like more integrative. I wanted to talk about, like, you said the idea is like understanding. So how do you think we can effectively communicate these ideas to better foster comprehension and understanding? I think second, also, how do we deal with the pushback from, like, you were talking a little bit earlier about like the politics and publication, like how do you deal with the pushback if you're trying to be more, use this new way of knowing against a more traditional perspective?
Well, in terms of pushback from publication, getting rejected by journals is a standard pop experience. And you don't want to let yourself get discouraged by that. And it often takes 2, 3, sometimes 4 journals, sometimes even more. And the more unconventional your ideas are or your study in some ways, the more it may take. So you wanna be persistent. And obviously try to get advice from people about the specific manuscript, have other people look at it, what do you think, what can I do, and so, all that sort of stuff. But if you pay, but you know, this isn't quite as related an example, but you know the opera Carmen? Georges Bizet's Carmen, one of the most popular operas to ever exist. It caused a riot the first time it was premiered in Paris because people were so outraged at it. when evolution was first proposed, I think it was, well, maybe it's not evolution, I forget which it was, this major scientific theory that we now all embrace and everything. When it was first proposed, it was dismissed. Tectonics, plate tectonics was also, so, you know, it's just people. You shouldn't take people too seriously. We're animals. And we're biological creatures, and we react as we have evolved to react. And sometimes our reactions are not that helpful, or they're not that insightful, and so on. So, but of course you gotta live with it, so you gotta be realistic as well and protect yourself. I don't know that I've really answered your question once again, because, so let me give you this, we're gonna run out of time, but we are out of time, so I'll quickly say. In 1972, when I was a first semester student in the School of Public Health, my brother came for a visit and he said, Vic, you should learn Transcendental Meditation, TM. And I said, oh, really, why is that? And he had a few articles, there were a few studies, he showed me some articles. And he said it really helped him. And I thought, you know, well, if I learn it, it'll help him stay with it, because, you know, it'll kind of reinforce it, and it seems to be helping him, so I guess I'll do it. So I learned TM. A month later, my girlfriend learned TM. And we both noticed change in each other. I didn't notice a whole lot in the beginning, but I began to feel maybe I'm less not frustrated as much as I used to be about things. Used to be, you know, you're going to have an exam. I said, oh, that's abstract. I shouldn't have an exam. I calmed down a little bit about things. Then after a while, I began to think, this actually has a lot of potential for public health. And public health doesn't really seem to know about it. Jumping fast forward, I decided I would become a TM teacher. So I went on a six-month TM teacher training course. And I only trained one person, only taught one person. And I'm not recertified, so I can't teach anybody else. But while I was on the teacher training course, I thought, you know, there's some research on TM, but there needs to be public health research, because this is really going to offer something for public health. So maybe I should get a degree in epidemiology and do research on TM. So I went into epidemiology, and I told Bert Kaplan, who'd been my epidemiology instructor when I was in my master's program, I wasn't quite sure I should do this, and I said, Bert, if you learn TM, I would definitely apply. And he learned TM, and then he got me into the program, and he got me through the program, and when I finished, then I told you I got this thing at the Health Services Research Center, and I never did any research on TM, because, you know, when you're researching, what do? Well, you do research where the money is, and what your colleagues are saying, you know, this is something you should go into, and whatnot, so I didn't do research on TM. And also because doing research in TM is a little tricky, because the TM movement goes by its own devices, or its own vision, and you might have your study all set up, and they make some change in the direction of the movement, and all of a sudden you're kind of your study. It's like community-based research. The community, you're working with the community, and you get this grant, and now you're all set to go, and the community says, you know, actually, we think differently now. We've changed our approach, and then you got to catch up. So I was a little nervous about that. But anyway, I kept up reading some of the literature, and I kept getting more advanced techniques and going on residence courses, and I've now sponsored a number of people to learn TM. And if there's anybody here who's learned TM and wants to say something about it, you're welcome to. But I think it's made a huge difference for me. Hard to put my finger on it because, you know, I have a before after, but I don't have any control group. I think it really does broaden awareness, and I think it's been certainly helped for me. But I'm particularly excited about the programs for schools. Because in the schools, all the kids, this is like, so San Francisco, actually UCLA has a couple of charters, two, three charter schools, where they have this, what they call the quiet time program. I've got some flyers on it there. And in San Francisco, they have three public schools. And in Chicago now, there are a couple of public schools in a randomized trial, and it's now being extended to New York City. So in the schools, you have the benefit for the student who's meditating of the other kids meditating. So you're in one of these disadvantaged schools, and the other kids are not disrupting and provoking as much. So even if you're not doing your meditation, you're not at least being distracted and provoked in the same way. And what they found is that in over 3 years, it cut absenteeism by about 70-something percent, cut fighting, cut suspensions by about 70%. And the suspensions, as you know, was the on-ramp to the school-to-prison pipeline. So it's there are 10 schools in San Francisco that got on a waiting list to get into the program. So, and there are hundreds of schools around the world. This is not just in the U.S. There are tens of thousands of students in Latin America who are participating in this quiet time program. So anyway, yes, Kim.
Well, I actually finished my training yesterday. Thank you, today. He sponsored my TM training, and when you brought up being woke, I think at the end of it, like, in talking to the person who taught me, we distinguish between being woke and being awake. So I think you're more awake than woke.
Actually, have somebody explain to me what woke means.
In the sense that it's self-reflective, and it's getting out of the way, you know, when you were describing taking co-PI positions or asking someone else if they wanted to chair, I don't remember which
Sherman James, Minority Affairs.
Yes, I think going in with Transcendental Meditation helps to bring that, and now I'm only 4 days in, so I'm not like Guru Kia here, but but it, from my experience so far, it seems like it moves you towards being more awake to what's going on, more detached from the and kind of being outside, you know, being able to situate yourself within it, but also just see what's really happening instead of being immersed in it. So, you know, thank you publicly. I'm going to give you a card as well. But thank you for sponsoring that. I've practiced yoga and I've done other forms of like mindfulness meditation. And this is different. Mindfulness makes you it's too much effort, not too much, but too much for me, too much effort in contrast to TM. So it's not a sales pitch, but I wanted to publicly thank you, but also to where I see the connection and what you just shared today and in the training that I received.
Yeah, I think TM could have a huge benefit for public health. And I put the question to Kamara Jones when she was the speaker on panel for this National Health Equity Research webcast that we're going to have tomorrow. She was doing it, I think it was 2 years ago. And I knew that she was a TM meditator. Her mother had her and her two sisters and her husband and her father learn back when Kamara was in high school. And Kamara fessed up to being a TM meditator. She said, and I meditated this morning, which I'm not expecting to hear because she told me that she wasn't regular with it. So there are people prominently in public health, but she never talks about it. And never encouraged, as far as I mean, her daughters learned. But I don't know that she actually, in the people she interacted with in public health, you know, she was president of APHA. I had multiple conversations with the executive director, Georges Benjamin, of APHA. I had a conversation with David Satcher, trying to persuade him that Kamara's and David Satcher's Institute at Morehouse Medical School. Not a whole lot of openness to it yet. Now, the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, former Surgeon General, he visited a couple of the schools in San Francisco, and he has talked about it in TEDMED and put a Facebook post up about it. I think I've got one of those flyers there, has the picture of Vivek Murthy, or I have some in my briefcase still. So I really think we could do, we could make some difference by getting more people to practice TM. Now, will it eliminate racism? Obviously not immediately, and maybe never, but it, for the people who are victims of racism, I think it can be a real benefit. And for the people who are perpetrators of racism, I think it may weaken their commitment to it. Because, as Kia said, your awareness broadens. You don't get as trapped in particular emotions and things that may be pulling you in one place or another. And you learn to appreciate. And you, it automatically, I mean, it's not that you have to tell yourself, oh, I need to appreciate, I'm a meditator. It's that just spontaneously appreciate people. And when you appreciate people, it opens you to opportunities, things they can offer to you that you might have written them off about. You wouldn't have learned of it because you weren't kind of paying attention to them. So I don't think there's, I don't know anything we can do in public health that would have more impact. I mean, sure, if we had $100 billion for things like that, yeah, but in terms of modest amounts of money, I think it would be a huge impact to have some people here in Chandra Center, for example, who were practicing TM, and then telling other people about it.
Well, we do have one. At least one.
Okay. And if you want two more, I will finance them. I will give you two scholarships for TM.
Thank you. You know that's going on Twitter, right?
It's the people that you would designate from the center.
Right, right. But we're so active on Twitter.
Well, you know, at the School of Social Work at UNC, they asked me for an annual donation, as they always do. And I've donated them in the past. And I said, well, you know, I'm making more of my donations related to TM. if you have a faculty member or a student or a staff member who wants to learn, I would donate to that. And the person there, the development person, sent around an email. I've actually made this offer to UNC School of Public Health and Columbia and Guilford. And nobody's taking it. The School of Social Work sent out an email and got, I think it was four faculty who said they'd be interested, and a doctoral student and a staff member. So I increased the amount I offered to give, and my brother donated, and the meditator in Chapel Hill donated. And so far, two faculty and one doctoral student have learned, but I'm expecting that more will be learning soon. So my hope is that maybe public health isn't going to pick it up, but social work would be a very good field to pick it up. I mean, people don't realize that David Lynch Foundation has been funding these programs. So they've got this quiet time program in schools. They've got a collaboration with the New York Family Justice Center for women who are victims of domestic violence. They've got a program with the military for veterans suffering from PTSD. There was an article that just came out in Lancet Psychiatry last year about the effectiveness of TM compared to the usual exposure therapy they do. They've got things in prisons. I'm forgetting a couple of the others. But so it's a public health program that public health has yet to really discover.
Well, we'll definitely take it up on that. And with that, I wanted to say thank you for your generosity, sharing very deeply and personally, and for your work over the years.
Thank you.